It's Monday, February 15th. It was the worst rebuke in presidential history. It was also a victory. We start here. The final vote on President Trump's first term means he can run for a second.
They were threatening to drag this whole thing on for weeks.
Today, we're going to walk you through everything you missed this weekend in the impeachment trial.
It's going to take a long time to wind down Trumpism.
Along with what the final vote means for legacies. And you don't need to be a straight-A student to understand what this means.
You absolutely have to have that 6 feet of distance among students.
Why new guidance from the CDC could mean more online classes through the summer. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. This weekend, you probably heard, we just completed the fourth presidential impeachment trial in American history. And just to put this in context for you, the first was back in the day with Andrew Johnson, who got impeached for replacing a member of his cabinet without congressional approval. The second was Bill Clinton for lying under oath. Neither of these men lost a single Senate vote from their own party. That tradition changed last year when Mitt Romney voted to convict President Trump of abusing his power.
Each senator, when his or her name is called, will stand in his or her place. And they'll vote guilty or not guilty as required by rule.
Well, this weekend, President Trump faced his second judgment on perhaps the most serious charge to ever face a president, inciting an insurrection after being voted out of office.
Mr. Young, not guilty.
So there you have it. 57 votes for guilty, 43 for not guilty. The president is acquitted. It takes 67 votes. It takes two-thirds of the Senate.
Spoiler alert, he was acquitted. I'm going to go out on a limb and assume you knew that. But going into that final vote, it was actually unclear how many Republicans would go ahead and vote to convict their former president. Well, in a 24-hour period, there were several developments that actually put that question in even starker terms. So, if you were only half paying attention or you're just blissfully unaware this weekend, I'm jealous of you. I want to start the show with a quick recap of how this impeachment trial went down, because what happened here is on the record forever and could have ramifications sooner than you think. So I called up ABC's congressional correspondent, Rachel Scott, who was there for all of this, and I asked her to give me the cliff notes. Hey, Rachel, thanks for being with me.
Hey, Brad, I'm ready to break this all down. Ugh, so busy.
Yes, please. So, yeah, can you just, like, explain what happened? I guess let's go from, like, Friday afternoon, because that's when President Trump's defense team took over. What happened between then and, like, Saturday night? What do we miss?
The counsel for the former president have 16 hours to make the presentation of their case.
So Friday really worked out probably like you expected it. President Trump's lawyers took a few hours to lay out their case, and they focus on the sole argument that the trial really should never have happened in the first place. They say that it's unconstitutional because Trump is no longer in office.
In short, this unprecedented effort is not about Democrats opposing political violence. It is about Democrats trying to disqualify their political opposition. It is constitutional cancel culture.
And they also took this phrase fight and the incitement of insurrection. It quotes Trump from that day on January 6th, telling his supporters to fight like hell.
The House managers spoke about rhetoric, about a constant drumbeat of heated language. Well, as I'm sure everyone watching expected, we need to show you some of their own words.
You got to be ready to throw a punch.
You have to be ready to throw a punch.
Donald Trump, I think you need to go back and punch him in the face.
That I thought he should have punched him in the face.
Feel like punching him.
I'd like to take him behind the gym if I were in high school.
If we were in high school, I'd take him behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
And so they tried to turn the tables a little bit on Democrats. They played this 11-minute long video of Democrats using the word fight.
We stand up and we fight back.
They're still going to have to go out and put a bullet in Donald Trump.
Show me where it says that protests are supposed to be polite and peaceful.
Saying that they have used it before as well. And Democrats are sitting there being like, okay, well, listen, our words did not incite a mob that stormed the United States Capitol. But they tried to make the point that former President Donald Trump said the word fight only a handful of times.
And we are going to walk down to the Capitol. They showed you that part. Why are we walking to the Capitol? Well, they cut that off. To cheer on some members of Congress and not others, peacefully and patriotically.
And they insist that his supporters weren't taking it literally, and that those people that stormed the United States Capitol, the people that broke in to the Capitol, did so on their own accord. And they said basically Trump had nothing to do with any of that.
Without objection, we are adjourned until 10 o'clock tomorrow.
So by the end of the day, they wrap up their arguments and everyone goes home and gets ready for Saturday. And pretty much both sides at this point think that this whole thing is wrapping up. They're gearing up for the final vote on conviction on Saturday.
Wolf, this is critical insight into Donald Trump.
But Brad, then something happened. You had this report come out from CNN, and it really detailed this heated phone call between Republican leader Kevin McCarthy and former President Trump that unfolded in the middle of the riot. And we knew that McCarthy and Trump had talked that day.
Congressman, the fact of the matter is that President Trump has not condemned this, has not called on the protesters to stand down. You've been a staunch ally of the president. Can you convince him to come out right now? Will you do that?
As I was stuck within my room, I called the president, explained to him what was going on. I know he put a tweet out. I begged him to go talk to the nation.
Don't McCarthy joined Twitter. Our special report on January 6th, saying that he was trying to get a hold of Trump. And now we learn more details about how this conversation played out. And all of this really came from Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler. She said that McCarthy relayed this conversation to her and that the conversation was tense.
After Trump tried to say to Kevin, "These are not my people, it's Antifa," Kevin McCarthy said to Trump, "No, it's not Antifa. These are your people." And here are the new details.
So you have McCarthy on the phone with Trump, and he is pleading with him to tell his supporters to stand down. He is saying, "Look, you need to get out here on TV. You got to do something." He's saying that he heard gunfire inside of the Capitol. He even said that his staff was running for cover. He was telling him to call his people off.
After he said that, Trump said to McCarthy, quote, "Well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are."
And Trump basically responded saying that he believes that these people are more angry than McCarthy is about the election.
To which McCarthy responded, "Who the F do you think you're talking to?"
But wait, so that means, Rachel, like, Trump's defense a few hours prior to this was, hey, the president obviously does not equate violence with political support. Like, that's not what he's about. Well, here are Republican members of Congress saying that as he's watching people break down doors, he's telling the lead Republican in the House that's what real support looks like, that violence there.
Yeah, exactly, Brad. And so you had some Democrats saying this points to a really important question about what did Trump know. And when did he know it? And why didn't he step in sooner to condemn the violence, especially if he knew possibly that his own vice president's safety was in danger? So after all this news breaks, the House impeachment managers are huddling. They are meeting behind the scenes, behind closed doors, until 3 a.m. They're trying to figure out what to do with this. They were expecting to go in and close this thing out. And now there's the question of whether or not there should be witnesses.
Good morning. We are coming on the air in the second impeachment trial of Donald John Trump because there is breaking news in this trial. We are expecting to go to final arguments and a final vote today. But there you see the lead House manager, Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, saying that he is going to call subpoena or at least one witness in this trial. Let's listen into what he said.
So then on Saturday morning, the House impeachment managers do something that no one expected.
We would be prepared to proceed by Zoom deposition of an hour or less, just as soon as Congresswoman Herrera Butler is available, and to then proceed.
They said that they wanted to talk to witnesses about that information that just came in. They said that that account from Herrera Butler was so damning that she should testify and she should share more about that conversation.
This entire proceeding is based on rumor, report, innuendo. There's nothing to it, and they didn't do their work.
And Brad, this really caught both sides off guard. I'm talking about Democrats and Republicans.
None of these depositions should be done by Zoom. We didn't do this hearing by Zoom. These depositions should be done in person, in my office, in Philadelphia. That's where they should be done.
And the defense team erupted. They're banging their fists on the table. There was complete chaos and confusion inside of the chamber. They take a quick recess.
If the House managers call Representative Herrera Butler, I think it is very likely that President Trump's lawyers will call Nancy Pelosi.
This really turns into a staring contest for a little over an hour. And as Trump's defense team is preparing this long list of witnesses that they're threatening to call, you had several Democrats go up to the House impeachment managers and said, basically, don't do this. We don't need this trial to drag on. Let's just move forward and let's have this vote.
Thank you, Mr. President. The managers are prepared to enter into the agreement. I will now read the statement. This is the statement of Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler, February 12, 2021.
So then after all of that confusion, they actually decide not to have witnesses at all. They move forward to their closing arguments.
Senators, do not let House Democrats take this manacle crusade any further. The Senate does not have to go down this dark path of enmity and division. You do not have to indulge the impeachment lust, the dishonesty, and the hypocrisy.
Senators, this cannot be the beginning. It can't be the new normal. It has to be the end. And that decision is in your hands.
The question is on the article of impeachment. Senators, how say you? Is the respondent Donald John Trump guilty or not guilty?
So after the final arguments wrap up, then it came time for a vote. So the vote gets underway, and we're still keeping our eye on the handful of Republicans who seem to have an open mind about voting to convict former President Donald Trump. And then you have Senator Bill Cassidy. Cassidy is the one that has been pacing back and forth in the back of the chamber. Really, this decision has been really weighing heavily on him. He walks over to Senator Richard Burr, and he hands him a note. And Burr leans back in his chair, and he nods in agreement.
Mr. Burr.
And then the vote starts.
Mr. Burr. Guilty.
And Senator Burr is the first one that really catches our attention. He's the first Republican senator that votes to convict Trump. Cassidy is the second.
Mr. Romney, guilty.
Mr. Sass, guilty.
Mr. Toomey, guilty. Mr. Tubbard.
So in the end, you had 50 Democrats who voted to convict, along with 7 Republicans. It was the most bipartisan impeachment vote ever in our nation's history.
Could I have order, please? The presiding officer, the acting sergeant at arms will escort the House managers out of the Senate chamber.
So Donald Trump is acquitted. And then after it's all done, senators leaving the chamber ready to go home, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell takes to the floor.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it.
And he just blasts Trump.
Disgraceful dereliction of duty.
Holding him responsible, saying that he is to blame for what happened on January 6th.
With police officers bleeding and broken glass covering Capitol floors, he kept repeating election lies and praising the criminals.
Honestly, that argument sounded like it could have came from any one of the Democrats. But here's the thing, Brad. Mitch McConnell voted to acquit Trump.
I've made my view of this episode very plain. But our system of government gave the Senate a specific task. The Constitution gives us a particular role. This body is not invited to act as the nation's overarching moral tribunal.
He says that the trial itself is unconstitutional because Trump is no longer in office and that he would have thought about things differently if Trump was still president. But remember, it was McConnell who delayed the trial from starting, pushing it back until Trump left office. So he created this whole scenario. He essentially gave himself an out here. He created this process that pushed the trial back until Trump left office, and now he's saying, because he's out of office, he can't vote to convict him.
Whew, what a ride. All right, Rachel, thank you for walking us through that. Really, really helpful.
Thanks, Brad.
So that gets you caught up. But what does this mean going forward? I want to quickly bring in ABC's political director, Rick Klein. And Rick, I mean, when I hear Mitch McConnell there, it was as if he was saying out loud, oh, Trump is totally guilty of inciting an insurrection. I'm just not going to vote guilty. Like, why? Like, what are the considerations that Republicans were making in their minds over the weekend?
Yeah, Brad, it's wild. Mitch McConnell sounded like someone who really wanted to vote guilty and thinks now that maybe the Justice Department should be investigating President Trump's conduct.
Unless the statute of limitations is run, still liable for everything he did while he's in office. Didn't get away with anything yet. Yeah.
And I think for a lot of Republicans, they were split between the clear judgment based on the facts and what they witnessed. Donald Trump did something really bad, and it deserves to be called out. In fact, I think for the future of the party, they feel like it has to be called out. But
there were just a number of questions. I think there were unanswered, the timeline.
For some combination of technical legal reasons and broad political considerations, namely that the Republican base kind of disagrees with them.
It's an uncomfortable vote.
A lot of them found that they were pulling a punch in that final vote and did not, in fact, vote guilty. And to have only those seven Republicans cross over with the Democrats was itself a statement about Donald Trump's continued hold on the party.
Yeah, what did the math tell us? Like, the senators who voted guilty, why were they okay voting guilty and the not guilty people voting not guilty?
Yeah, it was mostly a familiar mix of folks who aren't going to face the voters again, who aren't up for a little while, or who just have personal political brands that are so distinct from the president. But it's funny, Brad, 7 out of 50, you know, that's 14%. Our poll out this morning, our ABC Ipsos poll this morning, 14% of Republicans nationwide think that President Trump should have been found guilty. It's exactly the same math. That's exactly, it's incredible. That's how the party is divided at this moment. And that is quite a statement. And again, 14% doesn't sound like a lot, but think about how popular President Trump has been inside his own party.
Right.
His popularity rating has typically been well into the 90s. So you're seeing Republicans turn, albeit maybe slowly.
Well, but I guess I'm confused, though, because you got all these senators who clearly think President Trump did something bad, that he shouldn't run again. But didn't this vote keep him as the face of the Republican Party? Like, he can run again now for whatever he wants. And who else really is there practically that could stop him?
He is going to view this as vindication, rightly or wrongly. But I do think it's a reflection of where we're at now for the party.
Seven Republicans voted to convict Trump. At least one is already feeling the political backlash. Louisiana's Republican Party saying it has unanimously voted to censure Senator Bill Cassidy because he voted to convict.
You are part of the problem with D.C. Don't expect a warm welcome when you come home to Louisiana. Your response?
I had the privilege of having the facts before me.
Republican elected office holders are now they're leading from behind when it comes to their voters. And, mm-hmm. and the voters are somewhere that they really can't even mold.
And I said, Mr. President, this MAGA movement needs to continue. We need to unite the party. Trump plus is the way back in 2022.
And the view among many Republicans, including some I talked to in the last couple weeks, they recognize that it didn't matter for Trump's hold on so many voters. It doesn't matter what the facts are. It doesn't matter what the judgment of elected officials are. Ultimately, it's going to take a long time to wind down Trumpism. And this vote may have been something of an opportunity, but even this wouldn't have quieted President Trump's supporters.
Yeah, and bizarrely, this wouldn't necessarily be the end for President Trump, because the Biden Justice Department could still be looking into stuff if the whole rationale is, hey, we can't touch him. He's not the president anymore. The Justice Department could, but you can't imagine that Joe Biden wants to go down that path. He's ready for this to be the Biden era, not the Trump era any longer. Rick Klein, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, school's out forever. At least that's what it sounds like to parents. The new CDC guidelines after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan.
It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
At a small private school in North Hollywood this morning, teachers and students have no problem heading into class because recently, teachers and staff there were able to get vaccinated by a local hospital, which enraged families in the rest of Los Angeles because teachers there are actually not yet eligible to get vaccinated.
I feel like they cut in line, of course. Because how else are you made aware of this?
Without vaccines, the LA Teachers Union says it's a health risk to return, and as a result, the public schools are still closed there, while this private school, with tuition rates around $30,000 a year, is open. The local hospital says this is actually their fault. They reached out to schools nearby and offered to vaccinate their teachers. Sorry, we had the wrong timeline. Well, some of the hospital brass have children that, yes, go to this private school. Getting schools open is still one of the biggest hot-button issues in the country. And last week, the CDC announced it was going to provide guidance on how schools could do this safely. That guidance did not come until the very last day of the week, but it's here. So let's go to ABC's Ann Flaherty, who covers federal agencies. Ann, what is the CDC saying to schools?
So on vaccinations, Brad, they're saying that teachers don't have to be vaccinated to come back to school and to do it safely. They are, however, sticking with masks. And they are talking about 6 feet of distance. And that's no matter how high the transmission is in your area.
I want to underscore that the safest way to open schools is to ensure that there is as little disease as possible in the community.
They've said this before, masks and social distancing. But these guidelines actually tie it to community transmission levels. So they say, do you live in a blue area, low transmission? Yellow, orange, or red, the highest level of transmission. And if you're living in those red areas, they give you specific guidance that you absolutely have to have that 6 feet of distance among students. You're probably going to need to go hybrid at that point.
If we're at such high levels of transmission, we're advocating for perhaps more virtual instruction, and then if possible to do the 6 feet of distancing to do so and to open in hybrid mode.
But if you're in a blue area, you can just do it to the greatest extent possible.
Those areas where, in fact, only less than 5% of our communities are right now, low to moderate transmission, we're worried that people will not be able to get back to full in-person learning if we mandate 6 feet.
I was going to say, if you need 6 feet of distance between students, like there's no classroom built in America where like you can just have all the kids there as normal, but now they got 6 feet around them, right? Like you would have to have online learning for some of them.
I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, we're looking at public schools with, 25, 30 kids in one class. Some schools have gotten creative using the cafeteria as a classroom, for example, using the library for, to put students in. But I got to tell you, when parents look at this, that 6 feet of distance is what they're looking at because they know that that's code, essentially, for hybrid learning. It means your child is only going there twice a week.
They're done, especially my youngest is done. He's a second grader. He no longer wants to log into Zoom.
He's really struggled to find motivation in school. I mean, he's borderline depressed.
I think a lot of people have looked at this year as just a wash. I mean, it's just, it got so ugly and so bitter between the teachers' unions and the school boards in so many areas.
San Francisco city officials sued their own district and school board in an effort to get those students back in classrooms.
We're being asked to put ourselves on the line as frontline workers, but aren't being prioritized in the vaccination rollout.
One thing that I've seen is that looking at these guidelines, you have to have the transmission rate go down. If the vaccines can do that, if they can get the transmission rate to go down, that 6 feet of distance isn't as absolutely critical. If you can't, if the variants start to chip away at the success of these vaccines, we could be looking at more hybrid schools. The vast majority of schools in the United States right now are at very high transmission levels.
Right. Yeah. You look at the map. So many schools located in these red zones. Not because transmission necessarily happening in schools, but it's happening around them. And on that point, I noticed, like, you referred to the school year in the past tense just now. Like, we got several months to go. But I guess I am wondering, is it too late for all this to matter? Like, are there schools that were open up too soon in the CDC size that are now just going to shut down because, oh, the CDC said so?
No. So CDC has made clear that they're not going to use these guidelines to open or close schools. Keep in mind, Brad, they're not a regulatory agency. They have zero authority over schools. Mm. You know, what they're doing for the very first time is providing a very clear benchmark. We've never had this before. If your community transmission levels are at X, this is what you want to do. Mm. I think it's something, it's more of a thing that local politicians can look at, that school boards can look at, the unions, and have a little bit of a debate about how far do they want to go to comply with these guidelines. And I think it protects teachers in many ways, because they can look at this and say, look, our community transmission levels are too high to expect me to be in the classroom with 30 kids in one room. One thing that's interesting about that is, you know, President Biden says he wants to pass this $130 billion for K-8 schools.
How confident are you that the guidelines will be followed? And do school districts have the resources they need to reopen safely?
Well, George, the second part of your question is really a good one. I think that the schools really do need more resources. And that's the reason why the National Relief Act that we're talking about getting passed, we need that. The schools need more resources.
I think the money could be used to build out classrooms, and it could be used to increase distancing and to reduce class size. But how soon is that going to happen? I mean, I think if you're looking at this practically, that would be another couple years down the road. So, you know, again, all eyes are on fall. Everybody is looking at these vaccines to make sure that it drives down transmission rates. But I think in these school guidelines, what you'll see for the very first time is a very clear formula, a very clear benchmark that says, you know, if you can hit these markers, you can do this safely and you don't need vaccinations.
Yeah, we'd actually asked Dr. Richard Besser, formerly of the CDC, last week if teachers need to be vaccinated before they go back to school. He said no. The CDC seems to agree with him. Everyone seems like they're on the same page, except, good luck explaining that to teachers who are still wondering, why don't I just wait for a couple months until I can get vaccinated? A lot of high stakes here. Ann Flaherty, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
And one last thing.
Major earthquake off the coast of Japan. The power was knocked out to hundreds of thousands.
Houses and buildings were shaken, but no tsunami was reported.
This weekend, there was a 7.1 magnitude earthquake that shook Japan. Specifically, it shook the area known as Fukushima. Yeah, that Fukushima.
Debris rains down as people rush out into the street, stunned.
And then 35 minutes later, the tsunami racing at the speed of a jumbo jet.
The quake there in 2011 caused a tsunami that took 20,000 lives and melted down a nuclear power plant. This new quake did not come anywhere near that, but it injured dozens, it damaged a major highway, it cut power to nearly a million. And it turns out this was actually an aftershock of that quake, almost 10 years to the day. And I don't mean it was a smaller quake in the same part of the world. I mean, scientists are classifying this as an aftershock, that it sprung up within a particular distance of the original rupture in the Earth's crust. And this is more common than you think. While a normal quake is followed by aftershocks for days and weeks, a gigantic 9.0 can see after effects for years. In fact, scientists have speculated that some recent small quakes in Missouri are actually just remnants of quakes from a couple centuries ago. In the meantime, Japanese officials say Fukushima might take decades to fully recover, and that while a 7.0 can be catastrophic, it's still 100 times weaker than a 9. So for now, they'll just hope this is that quake's last seismic gasp. The plane wants to actually have the Olympic torch start its run to Tokyo from Fukushima. We'll keep you updated on how that all works out. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, at Start Here ABC. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Wednesday night on ABC. Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.